Welcome to Manga Kaiwa. Welcome back to Manga Kaiwa.
Yes, welcome back. And this is episode 7 of season 2, if I'm not mistaken. I hope I didn't mess that up. But we are back today with the top 10. Back at it again.
Yes.
Yeah, so I know the kind of podcast recordings have been a bit longer lately, so hopefully that isn't too bothersome. I guess we can try to shorten it down, but it is nice to kind of get all our thoughts out. Obviously, I guess I at least am going to try to be a bit less repetitive today, because I know that I probably contribute most to how much excess audio there is in this video. But anyway, so this was actually Ben's idea. He's been coming up with a lot of the top 10 ideas lately, and I think they're actually quite good.
Thank you.
Yes. And I mean, like, when Ben suggested it, I was first kind of a bit skeptical, because it's like, well, Watch Mojo does this too. But then I was like, wait, but Ben wouldn't just do a weird Watch Mojo list where Naruto and Sasuke are number one, right? Like, he wouldn't do that. And so, like, you know, like, it made me a bit more comfortable. So I was like, yeah, we can put a bit of a better spin on this. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I will say that my number one character is, he's pretty, like, traditional, like, classic. Like, you know, it's just how I feel, so.
Yeah. I don't doubt it. But, like, I guess, like, the thing for me is that I tried to kind of, like, make it a bit, like, you know, pretentious in how, like, you know, I pushed the boundaries a bit, just to make it a bit spiky, you know what I'm saying? But hopefully it won't seem too stupid when it actually comes out. So I was wondering, Ben, would you like to start?
Yes. All right. So number 10 on my list is Suzaku from Code Geass. So yeah, I think we've talked about Suzaku in the past, but essentially Suzaku is, like, I guess he's like an example of someone that, like, tries to do what he can, do whatever good he can in the current, like, political system he's in. Whereas Lelouch, the protagonist, is, you know, he's a rebel. He is someone that is actively going against the system, which sort of puts him into contact, or I guess, you know, into conflict with Suzaku, even though they have this shared history as childhood friends. But yeah, I mean, their interactions are very
they're ideologically intense, right? Like, I feel like,
yeah,
but yeah, that's a good one. Obviously, I mean, I think we did mention them in our Light versus Lelouch kind of comparison video, but yeah, I mean, Suzaku is, like, I feel, yeah, it's really interesting to see how, like, vehement he becomes and how willing he is to sort of, like, damage Lelouch despite their kind of shared good memories. But yeah. Nice. Didn't want to interrupt you there. Did you have anything else to add, or did I sort of, like?
No. Yeah, you're good. I think I'm done.
All right. Well then, I'll go to my number kind of 10 spot, I guess, which is Arthur from Fire Force. So I think a lot of people think this is a bit of a stupid character. And I mean, again, I don't think it's very good either in a certain ways. I mean, let's just say, I mean, that sounds weird because I put it in my top 10, but it is good, but it can appear quite cringe in a lot of, like, interactions between the main character, Shinra, and his sort of rival Arthur, which kind of make up this top 10 for me. So Shinra and Arthur. So Arthur is sort of like this character. It's like a typical Atsushi Okubo character, like the author of Soul Eater as well, where he makes them have, like, this really weird kind of almost random gimmick to their character. And that somehow is supposed to be taken seriously. And it kind of gets a bit weird for the reader, but it's just his style. So I guess it kind of becomes good in a weird way at some point. And Arthur really is an exception to that. He's sort of like a character who is delusioned. Like, you know how Killer Bee, you sometimes get frustrated with him because you actually want to hear him talk seriously at some point, but he just doesn't.
Yeah.
Like, in the most serious of situations, he just continues to rap. And it's like, you seem cool. Yeah. Why can't you talk normally? But it's sort of the same thing with Arthur. Like, he has this sort of weird complex where he believes he's the Night King. Like, he believes he's, like, Arthur from Camelot, from the Legend of the Round Table, the Knights of the Round Table, right? And he, like, upholds that constantly. He never breaks role, basically. He constantly kind of calls himself, like, the savior, the knight. And it sort of gets a bit cringe when, like, Shinra, who isn't really delusioned, but he keeps kind of, like, praising this idea of the hero, like, heroes are way cooler than knights, which is really vague, but I guess because, you know, knights are also heroes, but that might just be also a point of the story. But anyway, Arthur kind of draws power from how strong his delusions are. Like the more he simulates being like the Night King, the more he like is in an environment that kind of affirms that delusion of his, the stronger he becomes. And it's really interesting to see because like, especially in the later arcs of the story, they both kind of start to see, like I said, it's probably on purpose that the knight and the hero are kind of vaguely similar, but they're still kind of clashing against each other. But in the later arcs, that's sort of like kind of acknowledged by the author, I guess, in the sense that they both sort of start to kind of accept that each other's dreams are very similar. And they start to have like this admiration for each other, whereas before, like they kind of just thought of each other as stupid. They just thought of each other as kind of like reckless, stupid people. And at least the one thought the other was that. And I guess I don't know why I really put this at my top 10, because it's sort of like, it is very kind of weird and pretentious at a lot of points in the story. But overall, if I'm just taking it in the big picture, I think it is a nice touch to the story of Fire Force. And one of the things that sort of characterizes Fire Force, because you kind of see how Okubo is able to like uphold that style where it's like this weird quirk that actually is supposed to be taken seriously. And you kind of eventually do. And it makes you feel stupid, but it sort of is fun too.
Yeah.
So I think this one I'm giving the number 10 spot because it's a very good example of like a stylistic mastery, like just accepting and like owning your style.
All right. So, okay. So my number 9 is Faye Valentine from Cowboy Bebop. Yeah. So,
oh, I didn't see this.
Yeah. So, I feel like it's kind of weird because I feel like, when people think about Faye's character, I don't think most people would see her as a rival to Spike, the protagonist, but I feel like to me, she kind of is. Like, she does kind of like, she is a member of the Bebop, like Spike's crew, but I feel like she kind of like competes with them like in like certain ways, like in like, you know, like going after bounties and whatnot. But yeah, I like Faye Valentine a lot. So she's a bounty hunter on Spike, the protagonist's crew.
And, a 70-year-old, wait, isn't she like 70 years old, but she looks like 23 or something?
Or like something like that, yeah, because like she was styrogenically frozen. So like she's only like physically 23, but like she's much older biologically. So, but yeah, so and yeah, she is kind of like, you know, she's pretty cocky and like, oh yeah, I can do anything. But you know, I feel like later on, like she actually shows that, you know, she's like, you know, just like anyone, she's vulnerable and she has, you know, like when she learns about her past, you know, she kind of like, she goes through this sort of like existential crisis. And like, I don't know, I feel like seeing her development is really, is very interesting, like as part of her character. Yeah.
Well, I think like one of the things that kind of compelled me most about Faye, is that like, you know, especially her reaction towards Spike, like at the end of the series or towards the end of the series where he was kind of like not making it like, you know, very inconspicuous that he was resolved to go confront Vicious. And like, sort of like when Faye got the gist of the love triangle, you know, between Vicious, Spike and the kind of lost lover. I thought it was really interesting how she reacted to that. Like in like a way where it's like, you told me not to do this because Spike did contribute a lot to, I think, her resolve and her kind of mission. Kind of getting out of that lost gambling phase that she was in. But like, wasn't that her at the beginning? She was like a gambler or something like that? Or
yeah,
like,
she gambled. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that's a good pick, actually. Very nice.
Yes.
All right. 9th. I have something from the Baki series. Let's plug the Baki Netflix drop that just happened. Ben, go ahead. Tell us what happened on Netflix in the past few days.
Yeah, all right. So I think it was on the 30th of September.
Right, yes, yeah.
Season of Baki dropped on Netflix. It's Son of Ogre. I don't think it adapts like the entire thing, because that would be pretty long, I assume.
Well, Son of Ogre is the longest Baki part. Oh no, I think it's the second longest Baki part so far, so I don't think so either.
Yeah, but yeah, it's the first season of Son of Ogre, and I haven't seen it yet, but I'll definitely check it out once I'm done with Vinland Saga, I think.
Yep, and a lot of people think of Baki as a part-based series, but Baki is a part-based series, and Son of Ogre, I can confidently say, for me at least, and I think for a lot of other fans, is the best part of Baki. Like, there are two parts that come after it, one of them which is ongoing. I think Son of Ogre is unbeatable, even for those two successive parts. Like, I mean, again, this series, this season that just came out, doesn't even adapt the best of it. But my God, if there is one specific fight that is included in this first arc, I hope they cover all of the prison arc. My God, it's I'm watching it even if I am unable to watch anime properly right now. Like, okay, I'm just going to say, it's Baki versus Oliva. Okay, I'm sorry. It's just so cool. But on the topic of Baki, you know, I guess it's all interconnected. My ninth pick for the top rival is, so these are actually not the two, this is actually a rivalry that doesn't include the main character of the series, but it's Katsumi Orochi and Netsukaiyo. So Katsumi Orochi is the adoptive son of Dopo Orochi, the god of destruction, as he's dubbed in the series, who's like this legendary kind of older generation karate master who has proven himself consistently against some really tough opponents, like, for example, Yujiro, although he got beaten. I mean, it was impressive, the fight, even though Yujiro was probably just toying with him. But I think especially, I think the most kind of predatorial we've seen Dopo Orochi is in his fight against Dorian. And Katsumi is often cited as sort of like the person who will elevate karate to its like next point in its evolution, and in a lot of ways he really does. This will be expanded on Baki Son of Ogre, so spoilers, and Ben, you can shut your ears if you don't want to hear this, but it's not that much of a spoiler. There is obviously the Pickle arc, which I think you're familiar with.
Yeah, I know that.
Baki Son of Ogre, which is like where this prehistoric guy comes in, and in that moment, I mean, this is a really memed moment in Baki, but Orochi becomes really, really like determined, and he develops a technique that, you know, is like one of the first instances in Baki where it's like a technique, like, because there are also a lot of ridiculous moments in Baki before this, but it's like a technique that just could not possibly exist in real life. Netsukaiyo was able to go supersonic with his fists, and in the process he breaks them, and he does that by imagining that he has countless more joints in his arms. Like, imagine like the femur right here. Like, he imagined that he has like a lot more joints in his femur, so it's like a whip. And he gets them by imagining it. Like, I know, like, that's a common theme in Baki, like imagining things into existence, which is, I guess, part of the magic of it. But I guess I'm getting off topic. Anyway, in that whole Pickle arc, a lot of stuff happens, including the sort of severe injury of Netsukaiyo. And that sort of puts him on the down, kind of the downfall, I guess you could say. He has a lot of cool kind of self-discovery arcs where he actually joins a boxing club and becomes a very successful boxer, like using Jugo Kempo in boxing. But he's still injured, so he's not really able to compete on the same level he was with like the most ruthless, like battle to the death fighters like Baki and his father, as he was before. And eventually, Ben, you know this.
Yeah.
This is a massive spoiler, but it's kind of just pass away. But that is really where the beauty of his rivalry with Katsumi Orochi shines. Because in the most recent arc, and this is actually one of the best things that I think has happened in recent Baki. Again, it's also ridiculous, but whatever, it's beautiful. Katsumi actually, who I think lost his arm in a previous battle. I think it was against Pickle as well, actually. The dead Netsukaiyo's arm is then reattached to Katsumi, and that's his new arm. And there's, you know, as much as it's ridiculous, you get over that once he has his first fight with the arm, where Katsumi's Retsu arm moves on its own and uses Kung Fu, so Jugo Kempo, and it's almost as if like Detsu is living on in his rival, because these guys have a history of kind of like competing against each other and trying to beat each other. Like, and there are some pretty beautiful moments of respect between them. And they did also fight in the Maximum Tournament arc, if I'm not mistaken. And it's just, I mean, they haven't really fought in official kind of tournament terms a lot, but they have this respect for each other, I think, a lot of the times where, you know, they see the strong points of each other's martial arts. And that's what Baki is. It's not really a series about love or friendship or anything. It's about fighting. And that's basically as intimate as you get, which I think is why I love their relationship. And I especially love how Itagaki was able to execute that kind of like Retsu arm, like story arc, where Detsu is basically fighting on in Katsumi, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Okay, so my number 8 is Rohan Kishibe from JoJo Part 4. Diamond is Unbreakable, yeah. So
Ben whipping like, out those wild cards here. I like that.
Yeah, so I feel like what's interesting is that I feel like typically Rohan, you know, from Part 4 of JoJo's is thought of as, you know, one of Josuke, the protagonist's Joe bros. But I feel like, I don't know, because like, it's very, Rohan makes it very clear that he very much dislikes
Josuke. Just like Abakio to Giorno, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But I feel like his like, sort of like, kind of rivalry with Josuke is like, it's just so entertaining because like, he's like, you know, crazy things. Like, you know, there is this one moment where like, he and Josuke have a, like they gamble and with a die and, and like, and Josuke, you know, he is cheating, and Rohan knows he's cheating, but he can't figure out how. So like he stabs his finger with the pen, and it's just like, okay, it's like he's showing his commitment to like proving how Josuke is cheating. It's like, I don't know, but Rohan on his own is also a very entertaining character. He has this very cool.
He's like, Araki's favorite, even though he won.
Yes, he gets all these different spin-offs in that Araki the
protagonist. And he gets a photo of himself hugging Araki, of drawing of a rock that Araki made himself.
Yeah, so his stand, his ability Heaven's Door allows him to like basically I guess kind of like make anything that he wants to happen with his notebook, which is very overpowered, but like, then again I feel like he's not that powerful compared to like a lot of other characters in JoJo.
Or at least he hasn't exploited Heaven's Door's abilities to an extent that would make him as formidable as like Kira or something. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I mean, technically, if he wrote like explode into someone's notebook, like if he opened someone up and like made them a bomb, he could basically just replicate any stand ability, like become invincible or something like
true,
that.
True. Yeah.
Like, I mean, it is overpowered, but it's just not used. And again, I mean, this is a thing with stands that I don't think we see, that we see in a lot of other power systems, but like limitations. Like, I don't think there's ever been a moment where like a stand has an ability that is very vague, but once they try to do something insane with that ability, they can do it. It's not like they're limited to it. You know, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, for example, like, oh yes, you can use this overpowered ability where you can control people's minds, but if their willpower is stronger than yours, you know, there's kind of no if with stands, but that's what makes, I think, yeah, so frustrating in a way, because it's like, why don't you just use it the way it should be? It's like, yeah, handle. I feel like there are multiple part four stands.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because like, I mean, I guess, like, you know, this Zahando, you know, it's like, the stand is limited by its user. But yeah.
But like, that actually brings me to another weird, like, good point that I think is really nice about the Kishibe Rohan and Higashikata Josuke rivalry, is that, like, Josuke is just, like, he's not really an idiot, especially compared to Okuyasu, but he doesn't, like, actively try to be smart or intelligent, like, in an overt way. And, like, Rohan is a bit pretentious, like, in the opposite sense. So, like, it just, they irritate each other automatically.
Yeah.
That's a cool idea. And especially, like, where the house is burning down, but they still want to continue, and it's like, what the hell?
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. I think that's a really cool pick. Very nice thinking right there. All right. So, my number 8 pick is, unfortunately, something that we can't enjoy together, because I don't think you've experienced this series, but Tiki Mick and Alan Walker from De Grey Man. So, I mean, a lot of people would probably assume that Alan Walker, the protagonist of the series, would kind of more kind of intuitively be thought of as a rival to Yukanda, who's sort of like the Sasuke of the story. But I guess Sasuke is a bit too often brought up. You know, it's just the edgy guy who doesn't talk much and is full of hate and doesn't really trust anyone and all that kind of crap. Yu is also an interesting character, especially his relationship to Alan, but I think they're not really rivals in a sense because they don't compare each other to themselves in kind of like a, I want to be better than you way, or in a kind of an antagonistic way, as in like a confrontational relationship. But with Tiki Mick being a member of like the organization that is directly under the control of the main antagonist of the story, the Millennium Earl, he's a Noah. So a Noah being sort of like the direct kind of like kind of these beings that continually get reincarnated every time they're dead to serve the Millennium Earl in his plot to kind of like, I guess, you know, we don't really know what his plot is yet, but I guess it's a bit up in the air right now. Yes, I am also waiting on a new De Grey Man chapter, but even if we get another one, we'll have to wait another half a year until we get the next one. Hiatus. But, you know, I'm getting off topic. Tiki Mick is a really weird Noah because most of the Noahs are actually kind of like, they don't take anybody seriously. They're either very stern and they like, you know, just destroy everything like immediately. They one-shot everything. Or they're just like these mad kind of laughter people, like, you know, those insane anime characters who are kind of like, ha ha ha. And they always like joke around. They never take their opponents seriously, even when they're getting crushed by them. Like it's either one of those two besides Tiki Mick. Tiki Mick being the anomaly. He actually does take Alan seriously. And one of the greatest moments in Alan's character development is actually in like a very important confrontation with Tiki Mick in probably one of the best arcs in the series, being the arc. Yes, the Noah's arc. and it's basically where, you know, the power system of De Grey Man also shines very brightly, where Alan is able to use this thing called innocence, which is the power system of the main good guy force in De Grey Man, to vanquish Tiki Mick after he was actually already defeated by him. Tiki Mick is someone who sort of like is basically just following orders from the Millennium Earl, doesn't really have any sense of kind of ego. He doesn't really care for his own ambitions because he doesn't have any. And kind of like the way that he reacts to Alan and his kind of determination to just like try to find the truth in the world, even though he's kind of just being used by everyone, is really interesting because Alan doesn't really have any allies. I mean, even at this point in the story, he's being chased by both his former quote unquote allies and the people he always knew were his enemies. And Tiki Mick sort of like, almost like is chuckling at him at the sidelines. And you can see that he actually likes Alan a bit. And I don't know, again, it's sort of like an iffy placement. It's a lot of like sentiment for me. I really like the interaction between these two, and it feels like a rivalry. It feels like, you know, Tiki Mick sort of like jeering at Alan from the sidelines, like, hey, you're never gonna make it. Even though he sort of knows Alan's gonna make it at some point. He sees something in Alan, and that's why I honestly think Tiki Mick will probably play a pretty key role in the kind of climactic parts of the story if we ever get there, because of hiatus. And I just really hope to see more of their interaction. For me, this placement is purely potential. I think what we've seen of their interaction, their rivalry, if you evaluate it that way, is nice, but you just feel the tension between these two and you feel that it's going to become something very important, which I think is what makes it so great for me. That's my number 8.
All right. Okay, so my number 7 is Hiei from Yu Yu Hakusho. So, I guess, you know,
you got the trip.
Hiei does sort of like fall into this, you know, common trope of like the brooding, edgy rival. But like, I don't know, I feel he's a bit more than that. Because, I mean, you know, he is very cool. He's
a drippy man. Yes, he is.
A drippy, yeah. He is a yokai or a demon that, Yusuke, the protagonist, comes into conflict with as a spirit detective, but later on, Hiei sort of joins Yusuke's main group, I guess, and they go on, you know, these different like adventures and like, you know, fighting, I guess, in a tournament together. And but yeah, I mean, I feel like he is, you know, he has some interesting depth to him, because he, it's revealed that like, he is the brother of, I'm sorry, I'm trying to remember her name, but so his sister is another yokai, and she is very well, she's somewhat vital to the plot. She is involved in a I feel like I'm getting off topic here, but yeah, he is very enjoyable, and you know, he hears about his sister a lot, surprisingly, and yeah, I like him a lot.
And like with Yusuke, I feel like Hiei is like one of those characters like, Yusuke, you're so weird. Like, this is pointless. You know, he's kind of like the cold, calculating one, right?
Yeah.
Because I remember like, hearing you, like, I feel like this is a bit more of a traditional rivalry, right? Because like, I feel like Hiei is always trying to kind of like, I mean, I haven't watched Yu or read it, but he's always kind of like the one who kind of becomes powerful, and then Yusuke becomes more powerful, and it kind of becomes that arms race. Like, because isn't yeah. that sort of how it is, or...
I would say so, yeah. I feel like Hiei is kind of like competing with like Yusuke directly. So yeah.
And also because he's kind of like he's not human as well, which I think is, I don't know, it might sound a bit simplistic, but I think that's interesting too. And the fact that he's like yeah. not human, but that also like he somehow still respects, I don't know, yeah, these other humans. Because I mean there's another non-human in their group, right? Kurama,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do need to get to Yu Yu Hakusho at some point. Like, a lot of people do consider it, you know, the best anime of all time, despite the fact that it's much older than a lot of very highly praised ones as well.
Yeah.
Shows that, you know, the story really is great. And the animation, despite being old, is probably great as well. Alrighty. So, I'll get to my number 7. Do you mind?
Yeah, go ahead.
We got Togashi's at number 7, because my number 7 is a Crolla Lucilfer and Hisoka Maro.
Yes,
it is. So thanks to Ben, he bought me these manga volumes. I was able to enjoy the spectacle that was Crolla versus Hisoka in the 36th, and I think it was the 34th, no, the 36th volume. No, wait, what was it again? It was the 32nd volume, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I think like, well, the battle I think was in 34.
30, yeah. No, yeah, you're right. It was 34, and then 33 was the first one. Okay, that like was after the anime. Yeah, but that doesn't really matter. Why did I pursue that? But anyway, what makes this really interesting is that Crolla really doesn't care about Hisoka, you know, more than he really needs to. It's just this annoying guy who's obsessed with him. And again, you know, Hisoka has a lot of these weird battle crushes all over the cast of Hunter x Hunter, which makes him really creepy, yeah. But you know, that's not news to anyone. But just seeing like Hisoka legitimately be defeated by someone is, I think, so amazing. And for me, this is rivalry is encapsulated purely in that battle. Because obviously it's known from the Phantom Troop arc that Hisoka's very interested in battling Crolla because he recognizes him as a powerful opponent. But everybody who's encountered Hisoka has been crushed. Again, it's kind of been clear from the start that they were going to be crushed, because Hisoka is very early on established as very powerful. And a lot of the people he fights are pretty inexperienced. Like Gon, for example. But then also like, you know, the guy who's like, I'm going to kill you the last time you defeated me in the Hunter exam. Like the guy with the weird boomerang knives. Yeah. And this is the first time we actually see Hisoka like go up against someone really freaking powerful. I guess you could count Spike or not Spike, sorry. But the guy who they played, Razor.
Yeah, Razor.
The guy who they played the ball game with, but they didn't really fight. That's a beautiful moment, but it's a bit more of like a game fight than an actual fight. But just to see how kind of Crolla's weird, mysterious aura and just the kind of really lack of information that we have about his like main objective and like what he's aiming to do is really interestingly kind of like, I guess, interacts with Hisoka's just really boundless obsession with Crolla and just this desire to fight him. And I think it's really interesting to see how, like, you know, Hisoka isn't like enjoying this fight all the time. He's actually really infuriated a lot of the times when he's like getting kind of like outmatched and outwitted by Krollo at many turns. And it becomes kind of clear towards the midpoint of the fight that he's going to lose. And we sort of see that, you know, we kind of get a deeper understanding of the madness that Hisoka has. Like, you know, the fact that he wants to fight this person, but then after he loses, he goes and kills two of his guy's comrades. Like, what are you doing, man? You wanted this, right? And I feel like
yeah. It's
really interesting to see how, like, you know, this force of nature that is Hisoka goes against like this really kind of like determined, kind of mysterious person. And these are two very important antagonistic forces in Hunter x Hunter, and seeing them clash, just purely kind of independent of like the main storyline that was going on at that moment, is really interesting too, I feel like. It was like this kind of bubble in the plot where we kind of saw how, you know, the typical moral kind of disregard for morality in Hunter x Hunter. Like, the characters we're supposed to be interested in aren't good guys or, like, you know, these kind of typical shonen characters. They're kind of madmen, you know, like, they're interesting madmen. And I think, as vague as that explanation that I just gave may sound, I think it's just, again, another sentiment thing, like the last one that I had on my list. But Hisoka versus Krollo is just kind of a very interesting fight. And I think what makes me like it so much and what makes me rank it this highly is that Togashi is able to make an interesting rivalry mainly become as interesting as it is through one fight. Yep.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I guess, like, to add on to that, what I found interesting as well is that, because, like, in that fight, I mean, Hisoka, like, deliberately, he deliberately put himself in, you know, these conditions against Krollo where, like, they were clearly unfavorable to him. Like,
he literally found an exorcist so that Krollo could get back his abilities.
But you know, with him, like, you know, like hunting down the members of the Phantom Troop, it just shows that, you know, he's kind of a sore loser. Like, he can be a sore loser.
Well, because his life is battle. Like, his passion, he's consumed by the desire to battle and the desire to fight. And he has this kind of weird, like, implicitly sexual kind of, like, feeling with it. And it's just weird to see how, you know, he, like, that is just his character. And it makes him interesting as well as terrifying, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you can see, like, this is clearly, like, a mental problem that he has. Like, even if that's obvious, it still is important to, like, acknowledge that he wanted this thing, but being a sore loser is all he can do after he lost. You know,
that's funny because so this actually leads pretty well into my next one, because my number six is Hisoka. But I feel like I'm kind of, like, actually seeing it more from his, I mean, I like his rivalry with Krollo a lot. Like, I'm also considering his rivalry with Gon, and which is interesting because I feel like a lot of people would probably say that, you know, Hisoka is more of like an antagonist to Gon, which I would say that, you know, like, in the Hunter exam, I could kind of see that, but I feel like Hisoka is more of, like, a rival character to me, at least.
I would agree.
His rivalry with Gon is very entertaining as well, because he knows that Gon is severely, you know, at least at the moment, he's severely below his level, but he's just someone that's like, oh, I'll let you get stronger, Gon, but when it's time to kill you, when you're ripe, I'll kill you. So, like, it's like, you know,
I'll,
like,
pluck the fruit off of the tree.
He's always just, like, so eccentric, and he has the weird, like, sexual thing, which is, like, kind of uncomfortable to watch, but he's just so entertaining at the same time. So,
well, I mean, I'm not excusing it, but it is what makes him interesting, right? It's like, this guy is turned on by strong battles. I don't know. I think that's a good placement too. I mean, I think they're both really interesting. In fact, I would think that most people, if they were to try to find a rivalry in Hunter x Hunter altogether, they would probably choose those two, Gon and Hisoka.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, Hisoka, you know, that's what is so intriguing to me about his weird kind of battle obsession, is that it makes his interactions with different characters very kind of weird, but also interesting, like, and unique, like, not just in the series, but in manga and anime in general, in storytelling in general. Because with Gon, for example, it's almost like they both benefit from this weird kind of battle relationship. Gon as well is aware of how inferior he is to Hisoka. And that's why he only kind of determines, I want to punch him. I want to land one punch on him, which he does. And he sort of uses Hisoka as a measuring stick, while Hisoka uses Gon as like a sort of like, ah, oh, you're going to get so much stronger and then I'm going to kill you and it's going to be so fun and enjoyable and all. Like, you know, so it's sort of like they're weird twisted mindsets. And again, this is also referring to Gon's twisted mindset because it is sort of insane in a weird kind of twisted way that he's able to kind of like just say, hey, like, I'm going to go along with this weirdo schemes just to get stronger, you know, but that's another part of what makes Hunter x Hunter such an amazing series. Yeah. Nice. All right. Yeah. Well, I'll get to my number six. My number six is another Blade of the Immortal entry, giving some appreciation to a series that I don't think gets nearly enough appreciation. But this is Kagehisa Anotsu, a character we have talked a lot about, one of my favorite characters in all of anime and manga, period. And Kagemura Habaki, who is sort of like, I would say, the main antagonist of the series. These two sort of like become clearly, like undoubtedly rivals throughout the series. It's kind of like a gradual like solidification of their rivalry. But it's almost like a tragic rivalry in the sense that Anotsu isn't really interested in Kagemura, but Kagemura develops this obsession with taking down his Anotsu's kind of dojo or his group of followers, and especially him, I guess, the leader of that group. Because Anotsu is leading a group called the Ippōryū, who plan, I mentioned this before in previous episodes, to kind of like revert the Japanese kind of fighting philosophy to do whatever it takes to win, as opposed to kind of all these honor etiquette-based rules that they have kind of like used to limit combat. Because there's no really threat to one's life in a time of peace, because this takes place in the Edo period, which was relatively peaceful. And I think it's really interesting to see how Kagemura goes after this person relentlessly. Like, he is absolutely relentless. First, he basically kills everyone in the entire kind of like Ippōryū, besides the main members that weren't at like a specific moment where he kind of executed the slaughter. And the remaining members who, you know, I guess for the plot and incidentally, I just say are the most powerful members of the group are basically kind of in this position where they need to take revenge on Kagemura, not just because they want to, or not just because they feel obliged to, but because they want to, they just lost all their friends. And to sort of see how like this weakened Ippōryū, who've lost so much of their membership, which was pretty big, are basically now outlawed. And are chased down by this kind of obsessive man who thinks of himself, you know, as a kind of like an executioner of justice, right? Like this man is part of the shogunate, and he eventually goes down a very dark rabbit hole, taking a lot of pretty extreme measures to try to get Anotsu. And I'm not saying that's unique. In fact, we've seen that in a lot of kind of series and stories in general where, you know, people who consider themselves just use their kind of position of justice as an excuse to commit some pretty horrific acts. That's not new. But what really interests me is actually that Habaki Kagemura's failures eventually earn him an order to commit seppuku on the condition that he does not defeat or capture Anotsu Kagehisa and his gang. And that's what I think makes the finale of BOTI, Blade of the Immortal, so interesting, is that the finale is basically this desperate Habaki Kagemura trying to basically save his honor, not really his life. I mean, he would be able to save his life too, but it's more like, I want to save my honor by like hunting down this criminal who really is not any morally different than him. And that's what I think makes this rivalry so interesting, is that this man, Kagemura, dug his own grave, but he continues to go forward with it. And I think that is really like a pretty perfect and kind of encapsulation of the main message, at least that I get from Blade of the Immortal, is that morality is sort of insignificant in the face of your objective, because it's just impossible not to commit some immoral acts to attain your goals if there are people trying to stop you that think of their goals as equally worth their time. So at the end of the day, you can't just call the other person evil. You have to destroy them in order to attain your goal. and you have to accept that you will have to do some evil acts in return. That is constant throughout Blade of the Immortal, especially with the one of the main deuterogonous dream. But in this case, I just really love the way, especially the final battle between the two occurs. There's this legendary panel, a few of them from that fight, where they basically kill each other. And you can kind of see slowly but surely that Habaki Kagemura knows he's going to die. He's basically kind of like doing a suicide bomb, right? Like he's trying to throw everything at Anotsu, knowing that he's not going to come out alive. And it's sort of like beautiful destruction. And for me, this rivalry is so high on the list. I mean, at sixth spot, which is pretty good, because of how important it is towards the ending of the story and how it basically is the ending of a really great story. Yep. And yeah, I mentioned they're not the protagonists, or I mean, one of them is main antagonist. Actually, you could argue that they're both the main antagonists, which is really interesting.
I definitely need to read Blade of the Immortal eventually.
It's amazing. The art is also like, my gosh, it's pencil art, which is amazing.
Yeah. All right. So number five on my list is Grimmjow from Bleach. And yeah, so Grimmjow is, I guess, like another case where, like, you know, he's kind of like the antagonist for like a certain amount of time. Like, really, at this point, I feel like he's more of a rival to Ichigo, which is, I think, pretty accurate. I mean, he's kind of like someone that, like, you know, he's like actively challenges Ichigo, and he's like, you know, I feel like he also, you know, he's like very simplistic at first, but like, I feel like he kind of like pushes Ichigo into this weird like mini existential crisis, because I feel like there's this one moment in the Arrancar arc, or in the Hueco Mundo arc, where like Ichigo, you know, he goes to like fight Grimmjow, and Grimmjow is just like, oh, so you've come back to fight me again. That shows you love battle. That shows you love to fight, to kill, yeah. And like, whatever. It's just like this whole weird.
You're the same as me.
Like, you're the same as me, yes. Even though like Ichigo, like, you know, isn't really the same as them. But, like, you know, it kind of makes you think, like, you know, okay, fine. Like, Ichigo is like, you know, because like he's there mainly to save Orihime, but like, you know, he is also going to fight Grimmjow again. And it's like, you know, it's kind of this weird like mind game that, like, Grimmjow plays, like, makes him enjoyable. But like, you know, but yeah, I mean, he's just like this, and I feel like, you know, I feel like Kubo actually had like, Kubo kind of missed an opportunity, because like Grimmjow is already like such a great character. But I feel like if Kubo could have like capitalized, you know, on Grimmjow's rivalry with Ichigo even more, that would just be, you know, like a cherry on top. But yeah.
I think so too. But you know what what my personal opinion is that Kubo kind of bit off more than he could chew, in a sense, because we had two fantastic rivalry kind of candidates for Ichigo. One being Grimmjow, but the other, I mean, you honestly know, it was Ukiura. And I think at the end, he sort of decided that he couldn't do both. And he sort of kind of, I think, not really wanting to choose, but he sort of eventually chose Ukiura. That is my theory, at least. Because it would have been fantastic. And I am grateful that he showed up in the last arc. But I think what is so cool about the rivalry, and you're making me regret that I didn't put this on my list so much, although I'm not saying that officially, because I did think about this a lot and I'm pretty confident in my list. But just, it's so impressive to me how much there's to unpack in this relationship. And I actually honestly feel like we might want to, like, I don't know, expand on this at some point. Not in a recording, but just, I mean, I want to talk about this more. I don't know, maybe in a recording, but it's just because Grimmjow is almost like deceiving himself as well. Clearly, these people are drawn to each other, Ichigo and Grimmjow. They want to compete. They want to sort of like prove themselves against each other. It's sort of like this desire to interact with this person, not through a conversation or like, you know, any kind of peaceful interaction, but through battle. And that is what a lot of people kind of glorify battle as being, whether you think it's right or not. It's a conversation through basically trying to kill yourselves, which a lot of people think is the most intimate way you can get. I don't know, you know, whatever. I'm talking some backy crap right there. But I think it's really cool, because I think it like is probably one of the purest examples of a rivalry like ever. Like, it's pure rivalry in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I mean, I do love the relationship and how sort of like you know, it's not, I don't think Ichigo wants to go into battle. I think it's more specifically that he wants to fight Grimmjow because they both want to kind of compete and see who comes out on top. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very nice. All right, so for my number five spot is actually a pretty recent series, or from a pretty recent series that I read, Holy Land, this was a great series. It's written by a very dear friend of late Kentaro Miura, who has written actually a lot of pretty critically acclaimed series, Holy Land probably being the most critically acclaimed, but there's also like Suicide Island or Jisatsuto that I've heard a lot about. But Koji Mori is his name. And he's actually, I say this all the time, but I think it's so sweet and so cool. But I think in the works, he has announced that he's going to write a series about himself and Nero, like their relationship. And I mean, which I think is so cool.
Definitely. Yeah, that is cool. Wow.
I mean, because they're really good friends. And apparently, like, the main character who's in this rivalry was actually inspired by Miura, like the personality of Miura, which I think is one of the main motivations I had to read it. But even independent of that, Holy Land is an amazing series, and Kamishiro Yu's main character's relationships to all these characters are really interesting. And I think one of the coolest kind of dovetails here is that last time with Grimmjow and Ichigo, we talked about like, or we at least mentioned like this desire to fight, and you know how maybe Ichigo was a bit conflicted about that. And Yu goes through the same thing. He is bullied for his entire life and decides to take up martial arts, or teach himself actually martial arts with textbooks, because he's sick of it. He feels like he's being ostracized and kept from having like a place to settle down, to feel comfortable in. And he eventually gets involved in the world of thugs. One of the kind of primary characters that he encounters in his kind of like journey as the quote unquote thug hunter, which is what he's dubbed throughout most of the series, where he's basically just trying to beat up a bunch of thugs because he, you know, first he's trying to protect himself while he's in the city, but then he realizes that he's going to the city when he doesn't really need to. And that he's pretty ready when someone approaches him wanting to fight him. And he realizes again and again that he's actually seeking out this battle. And that battle is something that he experiences positively. It's something that he enjoys because he's able to learn about someone in the process. And all of this was spurred on by the fact that he wasn't able to go out. He wasn't able to enjoy freedom because of, you know, the fear of bullies and people kind of predating on him. And so the person that is the rival is Shogo Midorikawa, Midorikawa Shogo. So he's a karate practitioner, someone who is really, really interesting to me. He's probably like one of the purest examples of like a hot-blooded kind of like very competitive person. And he compares himself very, very, very strictly to Yu after he loses not once, but twice to him in what I think are two of the best fights in the entire series. And mind you, this series is very, very fight heavy. So there are a lot of them. And Midorikawa and Yu's relationship is honestly probably one of the best things in Holy Land, because Midorikawa becomes lost. After his defeat, he becomes very, very self-critical, to an extent to which it becomes obvious just how much he despises himself and his weakness. And he eventually sort of goes down this rabbit hole where, instead of like, you know, the typical kind of shonen, and this is a seinen, but you know, the typical shonen, I want to get stronger to beat you, he actually starts to kind of get, you know, into some really dangerous situations where he like starts to work with like these drug dealers and becomes addicted himself. And once it's Yu's turn to fight these drug dealers because they're ruining his holy land, you know, quote unquote, his town that he comes in his own with, which is a really beautiful reference by the name of the series. Midorikawa makes an incredible sacrifice where Yu is basically about to be arrested by the police, but Midorikawa sacrifices himself. Spoiler, sorry, that's a bit late. But the series ends, let's just say, in a very tragic way. And Midorikawa is actually in juvenile detention during that kind of very tragic ending of the story. And the kind of most important events at the very end, like the epilogue part of the story, is that he gets out of you know, detention, or he's about to get out, and he's just sort of like, you know, it's just this very kind of bittersweet ending where it's almost mirror-like, actually, where he's sort of like, you know, like kind of reborn as like a more reflective, considerate person because of the loss that he's experienced and because of, you know, the experiences that he has had laying down his kind of, you know, his safety for someone else, but then also taking so much for someone else because he learned to love this person through his fists, which I think is so nice. Homeland's a great series, and this is just one of the huge, like the massively awesome relationships in there. It's not just a fighting series. It's like, imagine Baki, but with philosophy, and it wasn't pretentious, and it also was a lot less ridiculous. All good?
Sorry.
No problem.
Yeah. Sorry, that's... Ooh, yeah. Wrong play. But anyway, yeah, I mean, that's interesting to think about. But yeah, that's interesting to think about because I feel like there's actually some philosophy in Baki Buggy. It really is, you know, mostly just fighting and
that's a whole other topic.
Yeah.
Like, is there any moral to Baki?
Yeah.
But is Baki just flesh? Is Baki purely flesh? Is that all it is? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But anyway, all right. So my number four is Serpico from Berserk. And yeah, so I feel like Serpico is kind of like this interesting rival to Guts the protagonist. Because like Serpico, like, I mean, you know, he's not like really in direct competition with Guts, but like, he kind of sees Guts as sort of like this, he does see him as sort of this threat to, you know, at least at first, he sees him as a threat to Farnese, his half sister's safety, because she follows Guts on his journey, and you know, out of like his obligation to her, so does he. So like he eventually battles Guts, and he knows that like Guts is so like far above him. Like there's absolutely no way like Serpico could overcome Guts in like, you know, a straight on duel. So like he has to fight him in these conditions that are like more favorable to Serpico, but even then, like when Guts is able to overcome Serpico, I feel like Serpico has this moment where, like, you know, he's like, okay, so I feel like, I don't know, I feel like I can trust this guy to keep Farnese safe, but but I feel like he is a very interesting character, I guess, in like sort of how like his journey as a member of Guts's party, but yes. Yeah.
I think so too. I think that's honestly a really good way to put it. I'm just as a side comment, Guts versus Serpico, the second Guts versus Serpico, because there's, you know, the first one in the Ascension, later one in the Millennium Falcon arc, one of the best fights in Berserk, in my opinion, hands down. It's just so amazing because I think what really kind of shocks Serpico out of his sort of distrust of Guts is the resolve that Guts displays. And I don't think he's necessarily convinced himself that, you know, Guts can protect Farnese, but I think he sort of convinces himself that he himself actually is interested in this. At least that's my theory, because Guts's resolve is that compelling to him. Yeah, I think that's my take on it. It's a really good one as well. We'll be hearing about Guts and Berserk in a later part of my list. Interesting. All right, so my number four is actually a series that I recently finished, or two series rather, or two characters from that series. So Tokyo Ghoul and Tokyo Ghoul Re, I recently finished them. Really, really freaking awesome series. Not just artistically, although that is a major plus, but story-wise, Tokyo Ghoul is up there among the best. It was really touching in a way that I didn't ever expect. Like, you know, Tokyo Ghoul really isn't just an edge fest. It is really, really nice. And I thought one of the most interesting character dynamics, and in my opinion, a fantastic rivalry in the series, was Amon Kotaro and Kaneki-ken. Kaneki-ken being the main protagonist, and Amon Kotaro being, at the beginning of the series at least, a ghoul investigator. And I mean, again, spoilers, but once Kaneki-ken becomes a ghoul, or at least becomes enough part ghoul that he is considered a threat and must be eliminated, Amon Kotaro, who's part of the organization responsible for managing ghouls, meaning exterminating them, confronts him. And it's their first interaction that I think establishes them as rivals in actually, I think a way that I'm pretty confident, like some of the people on this list, I'm sort of like, I guess you could not, you wouldn't really consider them rivals. But in this case, I think that ideologically, Amon Kotaro and Kaneki Ken are rivals because his experience with Kaneki Ken as a kind of fledgling investigator teaches Amon that ghouls are not purely, you know, evil. They're actually just very hungry. And while that doesn't make it right for them to kind of kill human beings, they need to do it to survive. And it's not like he realizes all of that in that encounter, but he's certainly has some seeds of doubt planted in them because he sees this ghoul basically spare his life. He isn't killed by the ghoul after he's actually defeated by Kaneki. And just seeing the way that basically, actually, Kotaro wants to confront the eye patch, as he calls him, or Kaneki, is really interesting. Not just in the original Tokyo Ghoul, but also in the sequel series, Re, where actually, spoilers here, Amon goes through a very similar experience that Kaneki did, meaning that he actually becomes part ghoul and is able to have the most intimate experience that allows him to understand Kaneki's kind of tragedy. And I think it's just such an interesting dynamic because, you know, Amon is someone who is kind of very important to the series in the sense that he's basically kind of coined the slogan of the entire series, not just himself, but the entire series, which is this world is wrong. Because, you know, after he has this experience with the ghouls, he's like, well, sure, like these ghouls can't do anything but kill humans. We have to kill them in order to protect ourselves. This world is wrong. Like this is completely stupid because he is in at his core, a just person, a person who wants justice. And he's also seen that way by a lot of his comrades. And just seeing the way that he sort of like, I guess, continues to try to confront the eye patch, not in a way that sort of like, you know, makes him kind of like want to kill the eye patch, but more like in a way that sort of makes him want to kind of talk to him almost. But it's impossible because for probably 90% of the series, they're branded enemies, like their organizations or their affiliations are in direct conflict with each other. And I think it's really frustrating, but that frustration makes for some tension that clearly is very rival-esque, right? Because, you know, Kaneki cannot talk to Amon. Amon cannot talk to Kaneki, even though they feel kind of this resonance with each other. They feel this camaraderie in their kind of like suffering, I guess, because they're both suffering from how immoral the world is, but they're kind of pitted against each other until the end of the series. Where they sort of kind of have to work together. But and that's one of the faults I will give the series. I didn't feel like there was a very conclusive kind of, you know, moment for the relationship. But again, I'm very grateful for the kind of run of it, which I thought was great.
Yeah, all right. So, okay. So number three on my list is Jean from Samurai Champloo. Now Jean is I guess, you know, you could also probably consider him, you know, one of the deuteragonists of Samurai Champloo along with Mugen. But I feel like Mugen is slightly more of the... Anyway, that's like another like thing on its own. But anyway, I feel like Jean and Mugen have this, you know, very interesting relationship. I mean, you know, I've talked about it before. They're both sort of brought into this like journey with, you know, Fu. And together, even though they start out as these like enemies that, you know, just start fighting each other because, you know, well, Mugen initiates it. But anyway, they're, you know, they're both determined to kill each other. But like, you know, eventually on, you know, on the journey, they, you know, they learn to like, you know, they gain respect for each other. And, you know, and when it comes time to actually like, when they're able to, you know, I guess, kill each other
on the
journey, you know, I mean, their swords break, which, upon, you know, striking, which kind of signifies that, you know, they, you know, they can't really bring themselves to do it. They just can't, you know, they've learned that they've kind of grown attached to this other person as much as, you know, they wouldn't admit it, but
it's like their hearts won't allow them, even if they kind of want to follow through with their promise. Again, a series that I know I keep saying I want to get to, but I haven't yet. It seems really beautiful. All right, so my number one spot is Knut. I think actually it's in the English and also in the Japanese, it's kanute or kanute or kanute. But I'm pretty confident that it's actually, as I'm in Germany right now, which is, I guess, you know, has some linguistic links to the Danish language, which is where a Knut is from. It's Knut, actually. But Knut and Thorfinn is my number three rivalry. Again, I think this is a bit of a weird pick, or it may seem like that for a lot of people listening, because we haven't really seen a lot of kind of like antagonistic interactions between these two. But at the end of probably what is in contention, and I think I'm pretty confidently going to say the slave arc, or the farmland arc, as it's also known, is probably my favorite arc in all of Vinland Saga. The conclusion of that is an interaction between these two characters that last time they saw each other were very different people, at least one of them for sure. Thorfinn having been this murderous kind of like, you know, kind of reckless kind of ball of destruction trying to kill anybody that was in his way, and especially one person, and now being a completely different person, and Knut being this very charismatic leader, sorry Ben, spoilers, whereas he was once a very kind of meek, he was once a very meek kind of like, you know, kind of childish person who didn't want to get really exposed to danger and all that kind of stuff. They are very scarred by their pasts, and they have the same determination. This is highlighted by a lot of people. In fact, I think it's often said in, you know, similar words in the story, but in narration or in dialogue, they both want peace. They want, you know, a world where people don't have to kind of be bound by this weird honor-based system where like might makes right. Like, you know, if you're strong, you will win and you will take what is yours. Because once you've conquered, by the kind of the law of strength, which is what is believed in at that time period, like in general in society, you own that thing. Knut wants to abolish that. Thorfinn wants to abolish that. But Knut and Thorfinn's approaches are very different. In fact, they're basically opposites, which is weird because they're going towards the same goal. Knut wants to do anything he can to achieve that goal, whereas Thorfinn is determined not to use the very thing he's trying to abolish it, if you understand what I'm saying, meaning violence, weapons, etc. And, you know, there are some beautiful quotes in Vinland Saga where, you know, Thorfinn kind of resolves, like, I want to establish a paradise in a place that is unreachable by swords and weapons and violence. Sorry, Ben.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, right. You know, I mean, hopefully this will get you a bit more hyped for it. I'm not trying not to spoil too much. Whereas Knut is sort of resolved to kind of reform the society that is already existing. And I mean, again, there is obviously going to be some kind of interaction, maybe even a conflict between these two in the future of the series. But for now, they have this weird respect for each other, where they're sort of like in this kind of unspoken race to see whose idea is truly right and truly will succeed, which I think is a really beautiful rivalry.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that. Yeah.
Well, again, most of the kind of rivalry part is in the manga, but, you know, Vinland Saga Season 2 is coming out, and I think they probably will cover at least some of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So number two on my list is Hijikata Toshiro from Gintama. So what's interesting is that so Hijikata Toshiro is the vice commander of the Shinsengumi, which were actually a real police force in Edo. In fact, Hijikata Toshiro is directly based on Hijikata Toshizo, who was the real vice commander of the Shinsengumi. But I guess, like, you know, Toshiro is kind of like Toshizo, except if he had a crippling mayonnaise addiction. But anyway, but, you know, I mean, I, as you probably know, Gintama is like, it's mainly a comedy-based series. So, like, his rivalry with Gintoki, the protagonist, is, you know, it's very interesting because, like, they start out, like, as, you know, these very traditional rivals, like, you know, Hijikata sort of, like, challenges, like, Gintoki he's sort of made a fool of Kondo Isao, who is the commander of the Shinsengumi, and Gintoki beats him. And, you know, that's where their kind of, like, rivalry starts. But, like, I guess, you know, most of the time it's just, like, you know, them getting into, like, these wacky shenanigans together. But but I feel like there's this actually very critical moment in the Farewell Shinsengumi arc, which is later in the series. But essentially what happens is that, like, there is this moment where, like, Kondo Iso isn't actually dead, but he appears dead. And Hijikata is just, like, in this weird state where, like, you know, he's, for so long, he's been, like, the demonic, like, vice commander of the Shinsengumi, this stone cold, you know, most of the time person. He was almost kind of seen as, like, the true, like, leader of the Shinsengumi, because, like, Kondo Iso himself is, like, a bit of a goofball. But anyway, there's this one moment, but in that moment, you know, Hijikata seeing Kondo like that, he's just, like, you know, in this complete state of shock. He's just, like, completely frozen. It just shows out, you know, how deeply dependent Hijikata truly is on Kondo. But in that moment, like, Gintoki, like, tells him to, like, you know, don't stop, keep fighting. And, like, Hijikata instantly sees Kondo in Gintoki, surprisingly. And Hijikata is sort of, like, able to gain his resolve back. But I just found that, you know, so interesting, because, like, he's, you know, like I said, he's, like, this typically, you know, stone cold, you know, stone cold, like, a lead guy, but, like, you know, he does have that sort of element of vulnerability to him, which, you know, I find really interesting.
I mean, vulnerability is often what makes a character interesting. I mean, that's kind of stating the obvious, but I think it's just, I mean, flaws are sort of what make conflict, and conflict is what makes a character and a story interesting, in my opinion. All right, so my number two rivalry is Guts and Zod. It could be said, similarly to how we discussed Hisoka and Gon, that Guts is far outmatched by Zod, because Zod is obviously an apostle, meaning that he has enhanced physical abilities and he's very kind of resilient physically. So there's not really much of a debate if both of them are going at full power, who will be victorious. In this case, I think it's more of, like, a kind of, like, you know, intangible tension that they have between each other. You know, Zod having this weird interest in Guts, even saving him at a very critical moment, which is, I think, probably one of the most interesting moments in Berserk to date. You know, it's very, very interesting that Zod gives Guts a weapon, whereas, you know, in a moment where he didn't have any, he could have died. And it just fascinates me to see how, like, you know, in the later parts of the story, when Griffith is able to tame, or Femto Griffith is able to tame Zod by defeating him and sort of, like, showing him his ambition and his abilities, you know, Zod still retains this interest for Guts. Like, this interest is almost like admiration and respect for the resilience of Guts. And again, you know, there's a lot of comparison between Guts and Zod as characters, like similarities that people have drawn, which I completely agree with. And I think, you know, this is obviously, I think, a podcast episode that I think might be interesting, but, you know, this triangle of Skull Knight, Zod, and Guts, my theory being that Skull Knight and Zod represent two paths that Guts could have gone down, or could still go down, who knows. One being sort of losing himself to, you know, his desire for revenge, or not revenge, let's just say, but committing himself to the destruction of this force of evil and the struggle against fate, or using the power of evil itself, the apostle abilities, to kind of become invincible and to continue his struggle, but, you know, in the process, I guess, losing his desire for, you know, like, conquering that evil. And just seeing how Guts has kind of suspended between these two, because he's not going to become an apostle, but he's not also fully committed to investing every ounce of his being into defeating evil. He also has other priorities, like Casca and his crew. It's really interesting, because you see how, like, Zod is just sort of fascinated with him. Like, from the beginning, when they meet in the Golden Age arc, you see how Zod is weirdly kind of shocked at Guts, and how he, like, continues. And my favorite battle in Berserk, I've kind of slowly but surely decided, being the second Hill of Swords Zod versus Guts battle, is really, really interesting, because, like, just seeing how, like, they come back, and how Guts is not able to kind of absorb the presence of Zod, the significance of it, because he's so obsessed with getting to Griffith, but still having to battle Zod, is fantastic. But what I find even more impressive And you know, this is a pretty simple moment, but is their fight against Ganishka, where they actually team up, creating what is, in my opinion, a contender for one of the best panels in all of Berserk, that final blow. But you know, I just think it's incredible to see how like they can't quite kill each other. You know, like even when they have the opportunity, especially Zod having multiple opportunities to completely destroy Guts, you know, he doesn't. And Guts also probably couldn't kill Zod if he, I don't know. I don't think Guts probably could kill Zod, even being an apostle and, you know, Guts despising apostles. I don't think he could kill Zod if Zod was like weakened and in a position where he could easily be killed by Guts. Because I think they have this weird respect for each other, and if not respect, this fascination for each other. And I mean, it's, I think there have been so many instances of this on my list, at least, of like, where I can't really put into words, like concretely what makes me fascinated with a rivalry, but with these two characters, it's just this like heat in the air whenever they're around each other. Like they want to go at it, but it's not because they want to kill each other necessarily, regardless of their allegiances and regardless of Guts's boundless, like bottomless hatred for apostles and like, you know, the kind of supernatural forces that are opposing him. Like, Guts even is a bit snarky with like Zod in like an almost friendly way. Like, you know, it's like, it's sort of like these people know each other, you know, and I think it's because of the battles they've had.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, me too. I just love their relationship. Like, and I feel like one thing I want to add is, I feel like Guts actually might be like closing in on Zod in terms of like power level. I mean, we haven't seen Guts go at Zod with the Berserker armor, but you know,
true,
I
guess that is true. That is very true.
Yeah, but that's, I guess, a debate for another day. But anyway,
yes, debate for another day. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, that is true, because I mean, yeah, Grunbeld seems pretty formidable, but yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not getting into that now. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so number one on my list is Vegeta from Dragon Ball Z. Yeah, so I know this is a very traditional choice, but honestly, to me, Vegeta is, you know, he is the quintessential anime and a manga rival. And so, yeah, because I feel like just seeing his, like, relationship and rivalry with Goku develop throughout the series is, you know, it's very interesting. Because, you know, we see, when we first meet Vegeta, he is sort of like the main antagonist of the Saiyan Saga arc. And, you know, he fights Goku, you know, initially having the upper hand. But, you know, Goku is eventually able to, like, overcome him in some ways. And, you know, Vegeta starts to, you know, develop this contempt for Goku as someone who, you know, supposedly is this, you know, lower class warrior, you know, with the capability of surpassing, you know, someone that's supposed to be an elite, that being himself. But, you know, throughout the series, you know, Vegeta has this contempt for Goku as someone who is, you know, who is like so powerful, you know, surpassing himself while being this, you know, surprisingly gentle person. But, you know, I feel like, you know, in the Buu saga, you know, which is the final arc of like, you know, the original, not the original, but Dragon Ball Z, Vegeta does, you know, sort of gain this respect for Goku as well, you know, as someone who is, you know, this gentle person at heart, but like is still able to rise up to these new heights that Vegeta, you know, can't meet, at least not initially. So I feel like, and you know, and in the end, like Goku and Vegeta are ultimately able to bring the best out of each other, you know, they're just being in this constant state of competition, but you know, they are, but you know, when it comes to it, they are able to like work together, even though, you know, they're not actually particularly fond of doing so. And, you know, and which is exemplified in their fusions, that being, you know, Gogeta and Vegito. And it really is, you know, it isn't, you know, they don't do it particularly often, but when Goku and Vegeta do fuse, it's an event.
Their
result is truly amazing. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I feel like, you know, again, I haven't experienced Dragon Ball. Again, it's a series that I need to experience at one point or another. But I mean, from what I know, again, it's such a pop culture phenomenon that I do know a pretty decent amount about it. Their relationship is pretty wholesome, actually. It's almost completely
devoid
of toxicity, right? Like, I mean, of course, at the beginning, it is quite toxic in the sense that, you know, Vegeta's pride is very kind of like an obstacle to like his recognition of Goku as an opponent. But I think once, you know, that is said and done, like they do really bring out the best in each other, like you said, but only that, right? They don't really like, you know, bring each other down, which is, I think, only possible with like that beautiful simplicity that I think is really characteristic of Dragon Ball. Like, it's not necessarily a deep series in terms of a character, but, you know, that doesn't make it any less beautiful at times, which I think is cool.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so my number one is Kojiro. So Kojiro, Sasuke Kojiro and Miyamoto Musashi from Vagabond. An actual rivalry, because Vagabond is a historical series and most of the characters are actually characters that did exist, or at least the main characters. This actually did happen. And I think one of the most beautiful things about this rivalry, I'll get this straight out of the way, is that the climax of the rivalry has not happened yet. In fact, it is, you know, clearly, at least, you know, from the tone I've gotten from Inoue's writing and the dialogue of the last chapters that came out of Vagabond, you know, Vagabond being a series that is kind of officially ended, kind of forced to end because it just was such a bad hiatus that, you know, the editors just decided we're going to end it. We're going to officially end it. Who knows? Maybe it will come back one day, but for now, that is nothing we can say for sure. But the last few chapters have made it clear that Musashi and Kojiro's rivalry is the path that leads to the end of the series, which I think is awesome because, you know, their battle at Funajima in history is quite legendary. Again, it is a legend. It hasn't been like historically proven or anything, but within the context of the story, it is definitely going to happen. Like, that is kind of foreshadowed to an extent to which it's 100% going to happen in the series. Like, we know, I think, in our heart of hearts as fans, and as people who've kind of caught up to the series, that that is how the series will end. And I think what is so fantastic about this is that this whole, you know, it's typical of Inoue being a genius writer and just all around skilled mangaka artist, you know, that he basically set up the whole series. He invested chapters and years, even in his hiatus, into building up this rivalry. Even though they haven't had many interactions, actually, Kojiro and Musashi, like I said, Kojiro being, I think, the primary antagonist of the series, like in a very untraditional way, because he's, you know, morally on the same footing as Musashi. He's a samurai that kills people. He's just a person that Musashi admires and is fascinated by. It's just so interesting because there's so much to say about this. I'll try to make it brief, but Kojiro is actually given a 6-volume arc, like on his own, where we don't see Musashi. And imagine that's a couple years in the actual serialization time period, like when you're actually there. That is a couple years of not seeing the main man and seeing Kojiro, who eventually becomes, I would say, arguably just as good as a character as Musashi. I wouldn't say better, but there are very, like, you know, competent, no, there are very kind of plausible arguments that say that he is just as complex of a character as Musashi. And knowing that this is how Vagabond will end, or that's how it was intended to end, which is one of the things that makes me a bit more at ease with the fact that it might not even continue, just like Berserk, because you know what's gonna happen, but these characters, they don't hate each other at all. In fact, I would say even more, they really like each other. And what is so interesting about the rivalry is that in my opinion, the best arc in all of the series, the second Yoshioka arc, bit of spoilers here, they do encounter each other. And while Musashi is going through this whole dilemma, this existential crisis, where he's realizing, like, you know, as he's nearing the top of the world of samurai and becoming more and more evidently the most quote unquote powerful, and realizing, you know, that he's second guessing the worth of that title, you know, being unrivaled under heaven. Kojiro is there, you know, in multiple points in the arc. And as soon as they meet each other, they like each other. Like, you can see it. Kojiro is deaf. Musashi is lost, emotionally completely lost at that moment. But they see each other and you can see, they know that they are one in a kind people. And throughout the rest of the arc, the second Yoshioka arc, as Musashi is going through this war with the Yoshioka, shedding blood, countless lives are taken and all that kind of stuff. In that whole bloodbath, he mutters the name of Kojiro as if it's like a good memory that he's clinging to in this moment. And after the post-Yoshioka arc, which is also in competition, I would say, for the best arc in Vagabond, even though it's just kind of like a post-Yoshioka arc, where Musashi's legitimately broken by his experiences in that last arc and has to recover philosophically more than anything else, he resolves that he wants to go with, you know, to where Kojiro is and to fight him. And I mean, it's not said that way, but it's just so beautiful in a way. I'm like, you know, these people are healing each other through battle. How is that possible? You know, and that is a message that Vagabond has sort of emulated a lot, in a kind of like a weird, in an opposite way. It's almost like a fallacy what I just said, because Vagabond has mostly pointed out about how damaging battle is to the victor as well, right? But then it's like, it's making it clear that Kojiro's relationship as a combatant, as an opponent in a life or death battle against Kojiro, is actually a saving grace to him, which I think is so cool. I mean, I love those two characters to the bottom of my heart. And it's what makes, I think, Musashi's development really cool too.
All right. Yeah, I'm excited to meet Kojiro, but yeah.
Well, and you'll be with him for a while, which is actually good as well. It's a bit frustrating not being able to see Musashi, but I think it's a really good experience too. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's not like Kojiro doesn't become a very likable character throughout that 6-volume run. Alrighty. That was
alright.
Alrighty. Well then. So this is probably, I'm actually curious as to how long this is. It might just be the longest episode we have ever recorded. I'm not sure though. I'm actually maybe doubtful of that now, but not. We'll see. Sorry for being too long in any case, regardless of how long it is compared to the other episodes. Thanks so much for sticking around, and we'll see you guys
in
the next episode. Hold up.
All right.
Ciao, Stumblers. Bye, guys.